In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, krill oil versus fish oil, yoga versus swimming, how to reverse the damage caused by antidepressants, open water swimming 101, and much more.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. We provide you with everything you need to know for total performance, fat loss, recovery, digestion, sleep, brain, and hormone optimization. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you just want to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Well, Happy New Year, Ben.
Happy New Year. Hey, let's get this podcast out of the way so I can go drink copious amounts of alcohol this morning.
I've already started.
I heard you went to a hockey game last night.
I did. I went to an Oilers Oilers-Kings game, and the Oilers won for the first time in, like, years, which is kind of cool. But I partook of some of the festivities in that I had a couple of really crappy beers out of really crappy little plastic cups.
Yeah.
And so if I'm not quite as smart and quick as I normally am, I blame the crappy beer. I hate the way I didn't get drunk. Like, two beers is enough to get me drunk, but I'm just foggy.
I've actually been abstaining from alcohol for the past week. Pat myself on the back for that.
Yes.
Oh, well, over the holidays, honestly, Pat's when there's like a party every freaking night, that's quite a feat. But this whole blog post that we're doing right now on the 30 days no alcohol challenge, where the guy, he did the blood testing, and then we went 30 days, and he just sent me all of his results from 30 days being off alcohol, and I'm like, holy cow. Like, I'm actually releasing the article this Monday at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, but I mean, it's like the guy has gone from, you know, an unhealthy wine swigging, you know, about to die of a heart attack type of scenario.
Sorry, Jason.
To now the angels are singing everywhere he goes. So it's pretty amazing. So
really, it's that significant
for that. Yeah, it's pretty significant. So
crazy.
And, I've got before and after photos and all that jazz. It's amazing what happens in just 30 days. So I figure a week isn't going to hurt me. But
yeah.
Like I said, let's get this thing done so I can go pop open a bottle of bubbly and bring in 2015.
Sounds good. News flashes. Well, 2014 was riddled with awesome studies, news flashes, posts, and all kinds of stuff, and this week is no different.
That's right, and we're speaking of popping open a bottle of bubbly. I guess we might as well talk about some other ways to make your baby stupid. this was actually...
Don't feed the baby bubbly.
Yeah, or yourself when you have the baby inside of you. This was actually a study on prenatal exposure to common household chemicals. And as I do over at twitter.com/BenGreenfield, I'm always tweeting the latest and greatest things I find. And this one was really interesting. What they found was that children who are exposed during pregnancy to high levels of two different chemicals that you're going to find in most homes, especially in the U.S., but elsewhere also, one called dien-butyl phthalate and another one called diisobutyl phthalates. This also just goes by...
I have that under my sink.
Yeah, the general term phthalates. They had an IQ score that was on average more than 6 points lower than children who are exposed to lower levels of those chemicals in their homes. And so the recommendation from this study was to do things like not microwave food in plastics, to avoid scented products as much as possible. That would even include like scented like shampoos and soaps and stuff like that. To be really careful with air fresheners in the car, to be careful with dryer sheets. And also, as we've talked about before on this show, when you look at the plastics that you're using, especially if you're pregnant, but I would just say in general, anything that's got a 3 or a 6 or a 7 on it, you generally would want to stay far away from those. So the magnitude of the IQ differences, though, is pretty significant. And so if you've got air fresheners and dryer sheets that you're hanging around the house, and especially if you got a little one growing inside you, you may want to think twice. So
I think the hockey arena beer dropped my IQ by 6 points, too.
Yeah, considering it was probably drank out of a small, cheap microwave plastic glass. Yeah.
Yes, microwave the beer.
Exactly. So another thing, and this also, I guess, is somehow related, and it has to do with your New Year's resolutions and the munchies and those extra pounds that you might get. And this was a study that I found in a magazine I was reading just a few days ago, and it was about marijuana and the fact that new research shows that people who are avid marijuana smokers, despite consuming more calories, often an extra 600 calories per day, had significantly smaller waists and lower body mass index and less insulin resistance, meaning less difficulty absorbing glucose from the bloodstream compared to non-smokers.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? So they suspect that there is some way in which marijuana, they don't know really how yet, but somehow it's working to improve insulin control and regulate body weight despite a greater number of calories being consumed in the folks who are taking in marijuana. The title of the study is called The Impact of Marijuana Use on Glucose, Insulin, and Insulin Resistance Among U.S. Adults, and it was published in the American Journal of Medicine.
I'm actually choking, not just pretending.
That's an actual choke, just for the record.
Want to get high?
So anyways, I thought that was interesting. Take it for what it's worth, but it turns out that there may be something to marijuana use and insulin control. What I'm interested in is whether or not the cannabidiols in marijuana, which are the non-psychoactive components, right, which are, for example, in the U.S., completely legal in all 50 states, that you can get, and you can consume it sublingually by spraying the CBD oil under the tongue. You can get it in a liquid dropper form, and I'm actually shooting a video about this right now. I'll put up on YouTube pretty soon because I've been experimenting with this. You can put it in one of these e-cigarettes, and when an e-cigarette when you're not burning nicotine in an e-cigarette, it's basically just propylene glycol and then any added ingredients, including cannabidiols or CBD. Again, completely non-psychoactive. But you still get a lot of the relaxing and possibly now the insulin controlling benefits of some of these extracts, and it's not hard. It's not hard in your lungs. You know, it's just essentially it's vaporizing, right? It's just the same as like if you're breathing steam coming off of a steaming water pot on your stove. So
the mechanism might actually be in the cannabinoids.
Yeah, exactly.
Or non-cannabinoids.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'll release a video pretty soon of me showing exactly how you do this drug paraphernalia video.
Do you have an e-cigarette?
I do. I do. I hate the title cigarette just because people associate it with nicotine and benzenes and a lot of these carcinogens, but the fact is that I've been able to use that for CBD oil extract, and also been able to use it, as I'll show in this video, with melatonin, L-theanine, and passion flower extract, and actually
crazy.
Been able to vaporize those prior to bed rather than using, say, like a supplement. And it's amazing. Really cool stuff. So give me a few days to get this video out, but I'll put it up over at youtube.com/BenGreenfieldFitness. And if you stay tuned to the Twitter channel, I'll talk about it there. So cool
I'm on
stuff.
The edge of my seat. That sounds really
edge
cool.
Of your seat. And then the last thing that I thought was really interesting was an article about how hard charging athletes or just like exercise enthusiasts in general can keep their immune system strong. And this was an article that appeared at Supversity. And what the article was premised on was the fact that consuming what are called immunonutrients or immune system supports, it goes well beyond just warding off the common cold, and that many of these things that are used as immunonutrients that feed the immune system can induce performance improvements, generally strengthen the immune system, but also shorten the exercise recovery period. And then the article went on to talk about some of the more investigated vitamins and minerals and nutrients that can protect your immune system, especially when you're in a state of hard charging performance. So one thing that they looked at was antioxidants. The two most popular, of course, would be vitamin C and vitamin E. And while they didn't really find any effect from high-dose vitamin E supplementation, they did highlight some studies that showed 1,000 milligrams or greater of vitamin C could give you a little bit of an immune-boosting effect and possibly cause fewer reports of upper respiratory tract infections. But as we've noted before in this podcast, with high-dose vitamin C and high-dose vitamin E in their isolated synthetic forms, there's possibly some evidence that it might blunt the response to exercise. Now, I have my reservations about the studies that show this because, frankly, the people that they studied high-dose vitamin C and high-dose vitamin E in, they weren't exercising that hard. So I'm curious, you know, if you compare an Ironman triathlete to somebody, say, riding a bike for 60 minutes four times a week, if there would be a difference, you know, if you kind of reach that state, which you do need that extra help from antioxidants. But vitamin C and vitamin E, not really the biggest wins in this one. Vitamin D, on the other hand, did have a lot of good evidence behind it as having a really good protective effect against respiratory tract infections and against a lot of the acute inflammation that can occur in athletes, especially when their immune systems get suppressed after exercise. So vitamin D definitely gets a thumbs up. And then the article also goes into some other things that tend to fly under the radar when it comes to helping out with your immune system. Glutamine is one. And while you can buy glutamine in its supplemental form, and the dosage that they recommend is up to 20 grams per day, which is pretty high, considering that a lot of capsules are just 1 gram of glutamine. You'd probably want to get like a glutamine powder.
That's getting expensive.
But bone broth is an excellent source of glutamine. It's one of the reasons that you feel so good when you consume bone broth, and why it does such a great, why it has such great benefit for the immune system. So I'm a bigger fan of getting glutamine from bone broth, and that's what we do, is just make a big pot of bone broth once a week. Another one is arginine, which is a precursor to nitric oxide. So it has a performance enhancing effect, but it turns out to have a little bit of an immune system supporting effect as well. Now, arginine, just like glutamine, is also an amino acid. So if you're eating a good range of amino acids, you're already getting some arginine anyways. But the use of arginine to support your immune system was one that I don't think is talked about too much, but it does have an immune system supporting effect. And then the last thing that the article talked about a little bit was lactoferrin. And lactoferrin is actually a component of colostrum, one of the things that I personally use for my immune system and also to improve my gut health when I'm competing. But lactoferrin is another one that has some really good antimicrobial activity and can protect athletes from infections. So really interesting article. I just kind of scratched the surface of some of the details of why some of these things work. But vitamin D, glutamine or bone broth, lactoferrin or colostrum, and then arginine, which you'd actually have to take in like its supplemental form, or else just eat a lot of protein-rich foods, all seem to do a pretty good job keeping you from getting the sniffles and the snots.
I love it.
I get laughed at. Maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever. But I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. And these are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Lila Q.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a Rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's five-minute workout just three times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order.
Listener Q&A. Ben and Brock, Randy from LA here. My question, krill oil or fish oil? Break it down for me.
Krill oil versus fish oil. The smackdown.
I don't eat krill because they are cute little crustaceans. Fish are just ugly, ugly creatures. But krill, they're so cute. They're little black eyes popping out of their head and
They're tiny
little legs.
Tiny little guys.
So here's the deal. So like I said, krill are these little crustaceans, and whales eat them, and small fish eat them, and seabirds eat them, and they've gotten really, really popular lately for a few reasons. The oil specifically
so hot right
popular.
Now.
So hot. Krill.
So hot.
That krill's so hot right now.
So hot right now.
It has astaxanthin in it, and astaxanthin. I almost said that
protects
like
your
I was
skin
from
the
I almost
sun.
Said that like I was from Michigan. Astaxanthin.
Ma'am,
can I have some more astaxanthin? it's what gives the bright red pigment to krill oil. And they say that the oil from krill has a higher concentration of EPA in it, and it also has this antioxidant astaxanthin in it. Now, the thing with that is that when you look at the antioxidant astaxanthin, that's pretty easy to actually add to fish oil. Like the fish oil that I use, the stuff called Super Essentials, mm-hmm. that has astaxanthin added to it after mm-hmm. the fish oil is made. But it makes up about 0.2% of krill oil, which is more than what it makes up in fish oil. However, that rapidly decomposes in about 2 to 3 hours. So it is true that krill oil has this antioxidant astaxanthin in it, but you can pretty easily add astaxanthin to fish oil as well if you wanted to, like the super essential stuff that I take. That has astaxanthin in it. It's a fish oil, not a krill oil, but they just add astaxanthin to the fish oil afterwards. Which is just fine to do because if you actually look at krill oil, when you harvest krill oil, that astaxanthin that's in it pretty rapidly decomposes. It decomposes in like 2 to 3 hours. So unless they're getting that into a really safe package state right away in terms of the processing, you don't have a ton of astaxanthin by the time the krill oil actually gets to you. Now, The ask the xanthan component, though, is it's a really pretty small part of the whole idea behind krill oil, because what they really try and sell you on when it comes to krill oil is the fact that they say that the EPA in it is more completely absorbed, that you get more of those omega-3 fatty acids in krill oil. And this was actually all based off of a recent study that was funded by a company called NKO, which is the leading supplier of krill oil. And what they showed was that when you take 120 milligrams of krill oil, it increases the omega-3 index, which is kind of the standard for omega-3 effectiveness, from about 5.9 to 6.7. And then they compared this to a fish oil, and the fish oil increased it only from 5.1 to 5.8. And this was the study that was used to promote a lot of the superiority of krill oil versus fish oil. But there's
About the same ratio of improvement.
It's not the same ratio of improvement. It is a significant difference from a research standpoint. But an increase of the omega-3 index in the human body from 5.9 to 6.7% is not going to really result in much of a functional effect. You don't even get much benefit from using omega-3s, whether they're from fish oil or krill oil, until that index reaches about 8%, and you really start to notice a dramatic difference once it gets up to about 12%. So when you're just using 120 milligrams of fish oil or krill oil, either way you look at it, it's not enough to make much of a difference anyways. But the reason that they only used 120 milligrams in the study, and this is the part that a lot of people don't realize, is that krill oil is about 15 to 20 times more expensive to make than fish oil. So if they'd actually used enough of a dose of krill oil to dramatically increase the omega-3 index in the human body and get all the anti-inflammatory and the joint protective and you know, even the potentially cognitive performance enhancing effects of something like an oil, they would have had to use a krill oil amount that would have cost you several hundred dollars per month of krill oil to actually get that effect. The other thing you got to realize is in that study, they compared it to a fish oil that was in what's called its ethyl ester form. And we've talked about this before on podcasts. When you're buying a fish oil, you have to buy fish oil in what's called its triglyceride-based form. It's more expensive to repackage the fish oil and reconvert it into its triglyceride-based form after it's been extracted from the fish. But unless it has been, you get very, very poor absorption. So, you know, that's why you know, I only use triglyceride-based fish oils, and I only use fish oils that have been packaged with things that keep them from oxidation, you know, including, for example, astaxanthin. So the fact is that, yes, if you take equivalent amounts of krill oil and fish oil, the krill oil is going to increase your omega-3 index a little bit more, but you're also going to pay 15 to 20 times more for the krill oil. And I say, why not just get fish oil? Like a good triglyceride-based fish oil, save yourself a ton of money and just take a little bit extra of the fish oil, right? So like I take I kind of bounce back and forth between fish oil. Sometimes if I'm ordering my multivitamin from Thorn FX, and a lot of people think I don't actually buy multivitamin. I do. Like I'm on Thorn FX's board of advisors, but I don't get free multivitamins. I actually have to buy them. Bummer. So if I'm buying my Thorn FX multivitamin, I'll buy the EPA fish oil from Thorn, and just to save on shipping. So that's the one that you know, it's a good triglyceride based fish oil, really, really high EPA content. It's a great fish oil. I like that they ensure traceability on that oil, and they ensure that sustainable fishing practices are in place. So you get a fish oil that's free of heavy metals and free of toxins. So I'll use that one. The other one that I happen to be using right now, because it's another one that I'll use if I don't happen to be making an order from Thorn, is the Super Essentials fish oil. It's this really dark black fish oil. It looks like krill oil because they've added so freaking much astaxanthin to it. And I like that because it has skin protective properties. But the Thorn, if you go to greenfieldfitnesssystems.com, the only two fish oils that I have over there are the Thorn FX EPA DHA fish oil, and then the Super Essentials fish oil. And I don't have a krill oil just because it'd be so freaking expensive to take enough of it to make a difference that I don't see it as a real logical choice at this point.
Hi, Ben. Really enjoyed episode 301. And particularly enjoyed how you answered the question of how to fix damage from birth control pills. I was also on Yasmin, and I was wondering what you think of using Vitex, also known as chaseberry. It's an herb that is supposed to help kickstart a woman's menstrual cycle and help boost fertility. What are your thoughts on using that in order to help fix or kind of regulate a woman's cycle after being on Yaz? I have not been able to get my period since being on the birth control, and was wondering if this is something that would also contribute to helping me get back on track. Thank you so much.
Chasteberry sounds delicious.
Chasteberry.
Actually, yep. It sounds like some sort of fruity cereal for kids.
To me, it always sounds like something to make you chaste. Isn't chaste like basically being absent or something like that?
Yeah, it's root of chastity.
Yeah, chastity. Yeah, that's what I meant. Like chastity belts and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah, that's what I think of when I think of chasteberry.
Which actually kind of makes sense when you're talking about the menstrual cycle strange way.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you in a second about what I think about chasteberry. But first of all, you know, go back and listen to the episode we did on the pill and all the issues that come with the pill. It's at bengreenfieldfitness.com/301. We talk about birth control, how to come off birth control. But yeah, you tend to a lot of times have difficulty getting back on your natural cycle when you stop the pill. And there's a few reasons for that. I mean, birth control pills are designed to suppress the growth of your uterine lining, and because that's what gets basically expelled during menstruation. Yeah. Usually, you'll have a lighter or a shorter period, and a lot of times when you stop taking the pills, you will a lot of times just have irregular periods or stop your menstrual cycle altogether. Now, a lot of times this can go hand in hand with things like high levels of stress or chronic anxiety or changes in weight. There are a lot of other things that can stop you from having a normal menstrual cycle. But ultimately, it's pretty common when you come off the pill for your period to stop. And one of the things that's recommended in natural medicine is the use of this chasteberry as one way to jumpstart your period and to get you back off of, if you're experiencing any type of menstrual irregularity, whether it's related to the pill or anything else, chasteberry is one of the things that's recommended for that. So chasteberry is this little brown berry. It's about as big as a peppercorn. And it comes from this tree that's called the Vitex tree. And it's a cool tree. So it suppresses the release of prolactin from the pituitary gland. And the reason that it may work, the proposed mechanism of action, is that when you have elevated prolactin levels, it can cause an irregular menstrual cycle or even the absence of periods. The other thing that chasteberry is it's a natural source of progesterone. So it helps to normalize your ratio of progesterone to estrogen. A lot of women who have been on the pill or who have irregular periods, they're progesterone deficient, or what's also called estrogen dominant. And insufficient progesterone or estrogen dominance can cause irregular menstrual cycles. It can cause increased levels of this prolactin that would technically cause an irregular menstrual cycle. And it can also even cause a loss of libido. And so by using chasteberry, ironically, it being a natural source of progesterone, it may actually suppress chastity and increase libido and also jumpstart a regular menstrual cycle. So
nice.
Some studies have shown that it may also help with the symptoms of perimenopause. So it definitely has some benefits, but it also has some side effects. The recommendations on chasteberry are that you shouldn't take it for more than 6 to 8 months at a time. I'm not quite sure if that's because there aren't any long-term studies on it, and all the short-term studies on it have only lasted for 6 to 8 months, or if some kind of nasty side effect like a giant tree growing out of your crotch happens after you've taken
start
it for
to get
more
a
than
Vitex tree growing out of your crotch.
That's right. So the other thing is that if you are taking dopamine-related medications, which I think we're actually going to talk about a little later on in this podcast, like antipsychotic drugs and Parkinson's disease type of medications, Chaseberry affects the metabolism of some of those. And so if you're on something like, you know, an antidepressant wouldn't necessarily be a dopamine-related medication per se. Usually those are more serotonin-related. But ultimately, I would be careful combining chaseberry with neurotransmitter-related supplements and drugs. But you can get it in a powder extract. You can get it in a liquid extract. You can get it in a tincture. You can get it in a capsule.
How about a jam?
You may even be able to find some yummy chaseberry jam to
chutney.
Spread on your crumpet and have with your cup of Earl Grey tea each morning. Mm,
delightful.
Yes. So, chaseberry, tally-ho.
Hi, Ben. I think that you are amazing. Thank you for everything that you do. Your book, Beyond Training, was a game changer for my husband and I. He's an Ironman. I'm a marathoner. And we just love what you're doing, so keep it up. My question for you is this. I am a 250 marathoner, and I tend to run high mileage, about 80 miles a week. My coach likes me to swim 3 times a week. I am burnt out on swimming, and it's winter, and I'm cold. I've gotten really into hot yoga. I love it. It feels great. Can I do hot yoga 3 times a week, intense 1 hour flow classes, instead of the 3 swims during the week? Let me know if I need to, or if you recommend doing, you know, 2 yogas and 1 swim, or if I can get away with no swimming. It's kind of what I'm looking for. Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
I hear you, Alice. Mm. Going to the pool in the middle of winter is kind of crappy.
Yeah.
Walk out with wet hair, your hair freezes, riding your bike in the snow. It's terrible.
Okay, so I've been swimming in my 60-degree pool, and the temp outside yesterday when I was in there was 24. So as soon as I got out of the pool, my hair froze, which was just crazy. And actually, if you stand in the pool in between sets for too long breathing, your nostrils and your hair start to freeze as you're standing in the pool.
Your eyelashes freeze together.
It's really cold. It's making me really tough. So anyways, though, I think we are going to actually talk about cold water swimming later on. But Alice is a pretty fast marathoner. I mean, 250 is nothing.
Yeah, way to go, Alice.
Nothing to joke about. And she runs, you know, 80 miles a week. I'm guessing that her coach is giving her those swim workouts for the same reason that a lot of run coaches will give their athletes swim workouts. And that's because swimming can give you such a big cardiovascular engine. You know, when you look at somebody like Ironman triathlete Andy Potts, who was like an Olympic level swimmer, you know, he's also a great runner, and he also has really good pain tolerance. And he's probably also able to stare at boring black lines for very, very long periods of time.
Yes. Just because of experience with that,
his history as a swimmer. And you don't get so much sensory deprivation with yoga. You don't get quite as much cardiovascular or quite as much of a cardiovascular strain with yoga as you do with swimming. And generally, there's a little bit less resistance with yoga. Now, there are exceptions to that. For example, if you do kind of a more like Tai Chi-esque style of yoga, where you're imagining that you're moving through clay or cement with your hands and producing your own isometric resistance by contracting your muscles as you move through each yoga pose. And I really like to do this form of yoga. Sometimes I'll do like sun salutations and, you know, a lot of the different warrior poses from yoga, but I'll move very slowly and deliberately, almost like the old man in the park, you know, the old Chinese man in the park doing the Tai Chi, where you're like, he looks like he's moving against clay or water or, you know, something like that. You can do that during your yoga, and you'll feel a little bit like you've been swimming when you do it, because you're just producing your own resistance. However, the cardiovascular strain isn't there, but that could potentially be amended as well. Don't laugh, but I use a training mask sometimes when I do my yoga. I'll use like the elevation training mask that restricts airflow. And so it makes yoga a little bit more of a cardiovascularly strenuous activity for me. And that's because it restricts airflow. If you really want to take things to the extreme, you know, you're doing these, you say, intense 1 hour flow classes. I don't know how intense those are, though, compared to something that I actually tweeted about this recently. I've kind of gotten on this yoga kick over the past 2 weeks, and I'm working on an article at quickanddirtytips.com about this. I write for Quick and Dirty Tips each week about how to do fitness yoga. But one of my inspirations for that has been Diamond Dallas Page Yoga, which is actual yoga produced by this ex-pro WWF wrestler. And it's just...
Oh, that's why I know that name.
Crazy yoga, where you're doing like the superstar. And it's not the warrior, it's the road warrior. And then you'll finish up like a sun salutation series, and then you'll go into his signature diamond cutter move. And rather than going into your relaxation pose in between, like your child's pose, is called the safety zone. So anyways, that's called Diamond Dallas Page yoga, but it's actually really hard. And I'm going into my
safety zone right now.
I've done it with my elevation training mask on. And honestly, it's tough. Like it's a workout. So what I would say is, Alice, yoga is not going to give you what the cardiovascular strain that your coach probably wants you to get, that you'd be getting from swimming, like that non-impact form of lung busting activity. But you could potentially, I'd say you don't have to do Diamond Dallas Page yoga. Your coach may actually laugh at you if you do that. But you may want to consider using an elevation training mask. And of course, the problem there is that if these are not 1 hour flow classes that you're doing in the privacy of your own home, you may get some funny looks when you wander into your yoga class wearing your mask. The only advice that I can give you is dress up like Bane from Batman. And then you'll just complete the look. Nobody's going to know who you are anyways, because you'll have the spiky shoulder pads, the mask. Shave your head, and start fights. And then you'll be good to go, and everything will make sense to people then.
You always have to talk like this.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Brock. Great podcast. Longtime listener. I do have a question for you. I was on antidepressants for almost 10 years. I was on a wide variety of combinations of medications, but for the last 5 years, I was on heavy doses of Lexapro and Effexor. So every day I was taking that, and it was effective for what it needed to do, but I'm feeling like I have side effects. So I've been off for a couple of years, but my mental acuity is way down. Sleep patterns are a wreck, and I am wondering if there's any way to put together a program to detox from that, or if there are doctors that I can see, or if this is a thing. So you guys always take such good care of these sort of matters. I would love to hear your thoughts on it, and it could be really, really helpful for me. So looking forward to hearing your response, and keep up the good work. Really love the podcast. Bye.
Lexapro and Effexor. I think both of those are SSRIs, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they are SSRIs.
Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
I'm not a fan of them. Probably no surprise there, but I'm not a fan of these SSRIs because they cause this short-term flooding of the brain with serotonin. And then what happens is a lot of that serotonin is left hanging around in the little gap between your axons. It's called the synaptic cleft. And there's a very fast degrading or breaking down of that serotonin that's flooded into the synaptic cleft. So what you get is more and more levels of serotonin are eventually required as your serotonin receptors eventually become desensitized to this constant flux of neurotransmitters that you're feeding in by being on this serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And so as that happens, your biology begins to rely upon external sources of serotonin. And when you actually are able to release your own serotonin, it winds up getting broken down way more quickly than it normally would if you hadn't been on an SSRI, because the enzymes in your synaptic cleft have been trained to rapidly break down serotonin. So what happens is you need these constantly increased dosage of your antidepressant. And then you also end up depleting up to 60% of the serotonin receptors in your brain. Now,
So they just start shutting them down because they don't need them anymore?
Exactly. You don't need them anymore. And you also have, a lot of people don't realize, you have serotonin receptors in your liver, in your kidneys, in your colon. And so those can also become damaged by antidepressant use. That can affect things like constipation. It can affect things like processing of nutrients, bile production for fat breakdown, blood pressure regulation by the kidneys. It's a really, really kind of a vicious cycle. And when you look at a lot of the meta-analyses that have been done on antidepressants, they've actually shown that SSRIs have absolutely no clinically meaningful advantage over a placebo. And there's very, very little evidence to show that antidepressants are effective, even in severe cases of depression. And so ultimately, I'm not a big fan of SSRIs to regulate neurotransmitter issues. I think there are better ways to do this. And of course, if you're trying to detox off of antidepressants, one of the first things that you'll probably need to do is look into some type of neurotransmitter repletion therapy. Now, what I mean by that is that repletion, for example, one thing that I've recommended for people who struggle with insomnia, a lot of times you have imbalances in tyrosine and what's called HTP. And so one of the things you can do is you can take like 3,000 milligrams of tyrosine combined with 300 milligrams of HTP. You split that into three daily doses, like 1,000 of tyrosine and 100 of HTP. At breakfast, at lunch, and at dinner, and that can help to rebalance a lot of the neurotransmitters that are imbalanced in relation to insomnia. And that's just one very simple example of neurotransmitter repletion. And there are blends of tyrosine and 5-HTP that come in those exact ratios. Like there's one called Travacor by a company called Nutriscience. There's one called Neuro-5-HTP by a company called Biotics. And there's one called Crave-Arrest by Designs for Health. But all of those are just tyrosine 5-HTP blends because it's a pretty proven ratio for things like neurotransmitter imbalances, specifically the type that cause insomnia. Other examples.
I'm going to interrupt for a second.
Go ahead.
Ben is not a doctor, and this should not be taken as medical advice.
Well, that's what I was just about to get into. There is a doctor who specializes in neurotransmitter repletion therapy. His name is Dr. Daniel Kalish. I'll put a link to his website in the show notes. But if you visit the Kalish Institute website, or if you read the Kalish Method book, or if you speak with one of his licensed Kalish practitioners prior to experimenting with any of this stuff, it'd be a really good idea. If you want to delve into the science, one of the websites I really like is called neuroassist.com. NEUROAssist.com. Ton of really good studies on neurotransmitter repletion. But you shouldn't rely on, yours truly, a personal trainer and nutritionist to walk you through something as complex as this. Like if I was really concerned about my own neurotransmitter repletion, I would hop on the phone with Dr. Kalish or, fly and see him or visit his website and find a local practitioner or someone.
Yeah, there's tons of Kalish practitioners around.
Yeah, and a lot of them can work with you remotely. And one of the things you'll find yourself doing in many cases is a test. There's a test, for example, called the neuroadrenal expanded test. And it tests for urinary neurotransmitters like epinephrine and norepinephrine and dopamine. Dopamine and serotonin and all these things that can tend to be imbalanced. And then once you've tested at that point, you can engage in smart neurotransmitter repletion based on your specific deficits and excesses. So that's kind of the skinny on neurotransmitter repletion. But again, like a Kalish practitioner is who I would go to if I really wanted to make sure that I was doing everything right when it comes to this. There's also a really, really good book, by the way, if you're not convinced about what I said about SSRIs, I'll link to this book in the show notes. It's called Rethinking Psychiatric Drugs. You can check it out at bengreenfieldfitness.com/303. And then there are other things. I talk about a lot of these things in my book, Beyond Training, that can help you with balancing your neurotransmitters or keep you from getting into a state where you need neurotransmitter repletion in the first place. And many of these are logical, like moderating stimulants or engaging in coffee cycling. And that's where for every month of caffeinated coffee that you drink, you take a week and you drink decaf to keep yourself from overloading the adenosine receptors in your brain. I'm actually personally on my decaf cycle right now. This is a week where I'm doing decaf. Yeah.
That's why you sound so
no
dumb.
Alcohol and decaf.
Dude,
you can be really careful with mycotoxin exposure, meaning like use a HEPA air filter in your house. Be really careful with the stuff like moldy coffee, cologne, perfume, air fresheners, all those type of things that tend to have mycotoxins in them. Be really careful with sensory overload, like really loud music. A lot of time spent at clubs or under fluorescent lighting. I'm saying this a little bit hypocritically because I just spent 2 hours last night playing laser tag in a laser tag arena filled with techno music and white lights, and I have to admit my sleep was not stellar last night, and it's because of that. My brain was was firing pretty hard after that experience. But the same could be said for like a really loud, scary movie at night. Like sometimes you do need to take time to breathe and let your neurotransmitters settle down a little bit.
Yeah, I was on Cipralex, which is an SSRI, mm-hmm. for about 3 years. And the thing that helped me the absolute most when I came off of it was meditation and breathing practice.
Mm. Yeah.
Like just every day, making sure to do it twice a day, taking time, setting it aside and just doing it no matter what I felt like or what the day was like. It just made a huge difference in getting my brain back in online.
Yeah. And there's even that new app called Muse that can walk you through this meditation. It's really cool. Like attach these things to your head. And I don't own one yet, but it's on my list of things to grab just because it guides you through meditation and relaxation.
Nice.
Pay attention to your gut. Remember that the majority of your neurotransmitters are made in your gut, and your gut uses a bunch of neurotransmitters. 95% of the body's serotonin is in the gut. So make sure that you're being careful with things like gluten, commercial dairy, things that your body might have a hard time digesting, like lectins and glutenins. And, I would consider maybe even trying out like a paleo autoimmune diet for 4 to 8 weeks just to kind of hit the reboot button on your gut. So that'd be another thing that I would pay attention to. Anyways, though, those are some of the places that I would start would be neurotransmitter repletion and maybe looking into this Kalish Institute, taking care of your gut, taking care of sensory overload, moderating stimulants like caffeine, and then being really careful with like mycotoxin and mold exposure. So that's where I would start. And best of luck, Brian.
Hey, Ben. How you doing? Just wanted to thank you for everything that you do for all of us and the listeners of the show. I had a quick question. I'd like to get into some more open water swimming. I'm currently living in Raleigh, North Carolina, where the temperature doesn't get too cold. However, we certainly do get our fair share of frosty nights. And there's a local lake nearby that I would love to get in. Been checking the water temperature, and it's kind of down into the low 50s. So my first couple questions, if you could talk about hypothermia for the body within cold water, specifically exercise. And two, if I need to alleviate this by getting an open water swim training suit or a wetsuit to use when trying to go for these open water swims in a cooler lake, if you could recommend some good companies or something to go with for an open water suit. So thank you very much. Appreciate everything you do for people that want to be more fit and healthy for their lifestyle. Thanks, Ben. Bye.
So you've really been swimming out there when it's cold enough to freeze your hair.
Mm-hmm.
You are the hormesis king.
Mm-hmm. And I love cold water swimming. It's so good for you. And we obviously, like just a few days ago at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, I released this big article about how you could do things, like how to use cold to both build muscle and burn fat simultaneously. It was actually a really good article. I think, I don't know how many people read it because it was released right around Christmas, but really good article actually for building muscle and burning fat, but it went into like foods, workouts, and also how you would combine cold thermogenesis with that. Anyways, though, go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com and just surf through the last few articles there, or we'll put a link to it at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/303. But yeah, getting into open water swimming, there are definitely some things that you want to bear in mind, specifically what happens physiologically when your body gets immersed in cold water that you need to be prepared for, because there are nervous system reflexes that are going to happen when you hit the water that eventually go away. But initially you just got to get used to these. So for example, when your body senses this intense cold, and it's very similar to the mammalian dive reflex that I spoke with the free diving journalist about in the podcast that I did with him a few weeks ago, this mammalian dive reflex, when your body senses intense cold, it sends these signals to the brain, and that results in this gasp of breath in, followed by hyperventilation, an increased breathing rate, and an increased heart rate. And that eventually begins to go away. And as a matter of fact, what a lot of cold water swimmers find is that when they enter cold water, they actually take this deep breath and their heart rate begins to slow, and they almost have learned to allow that to slow down their nervous system. almost like when Han Solo gets put into the frozen ice chamber and sent to Jabba the Hutt. You know, he's like, it slows down everything so he stays alive, you know, kind of similar to that. But initially your response is just like this hyperventilation and gasp, and that's normal, but know that that goes away. Another one is, of course, you know, shivering. And as your body produces more brown adipose tissue and it's able to generate heat and burn calories to generate heat, you'll shiver a little bit less. Another thing that happens is when you get the stress response to cold, your body releases this surge of catecholamines called adrenaline and noradrenaline, and this causes an increase in heart rate and it causes an increase in blood pressure. And one of the things that happens when you get this increase in blood flow and pressure in your kidneys is you have to pee. That's normal when you get into the cold water. Until you're acclimatized, until you've been doing it for a few weeks, you really have to pee when you get into cold weather and especially cold water. And that eventually goes away as your body, it begins to produce more and more of a hormone called aldosterone, which helps to regulate your blood levels and promote fluid retention in the body and keep you from having to pee quite as much when you get in cold water. But initially, you're going to have that gasp, you're going to shiver, you're going to have the stress response, your heart rate's going to go up, you're going to feel like you have to pee. And it's really cool how you get this adaptation to where all of that eventually starts to go away and you start to get a lot of the benefits of cold water swimming, like changes to your immune system. A lot of cold water swimmers report that they get sick less frequently, and it's because your immune system grows more stronger in response to frequent bouts of hormesis or mild stress from cold water.
That totally flies in the face of everything that your mother has told you about going out in the rain. You're going to catch cold.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, your mom was dumb. So you heard it here first.
Screw you, Mom.
anyways, though, you get better blood pressure regulation because of that effect of your kidneys and your ability to churn out more of this aldosterone. You get an increase in nitric oxide synthase, which allows your blood vessels to vasodilate and vasoconstrict a lot better. You get lower levels of cytokines, lower levels of a lot of the clotting factors that are related to blood stickiness. And, of course, you also get, as long as you don't engage in the often seen caloric hypercompensation response to cold swimming, meaning you finish cold swims and you just eat everything in sight. Mm-hmm. As long as you're able to keep that at bay, it has a good fat loss response too. But you do notice, you know, a lot of cold water swimmers are fat, frankly, because they are training their body how to put a bunch of fat tissue on and eating a lot. But if you do cold water swimming and you don't eat a lot and you're able to regulate your appetite and engage in self-control, it's a really, really good fat loss strategy. So as far as temperatures go, you know, and whether or not you need a wetsuit, you're going to see a few temperatures. So if you look at and we'll just use Fahrenheit for our examples. My apologies to people who go in
to the rest of the world.
Celsius, yeah. 30s, we can try doing it in Celsius too. So like 32 to 53, it's like 0 to 11 degrees-ish. So that's freezing, right? And when you get into freezing water, it's really painful. These are like the cold water swims that a lot of people are going to do tomorrow morning. You know, like the New Year's cold water swim, the polar plunge. A lot of people do this around the world. Doing that just for like 1 to 2 minutes in the morning, you know, icy, icy cold exposure can make you feel really, really good the rest of the day, but you do get weak really fast. And, you know, once you're in there for more than 2 minutes, you can get like, you know, skin burn and, you know, and your skin gets like this purplish, orangish red color. So, you know, you want to be kind of careful with that. But then once you get into, it would be about 12 to 16 degrees Celsius, 53 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to get into a temperature that's more conducive to longer periods of time, cold water swimming. You acclimatize to that pretty well. If you're in a wetsuit, you can swim comfortably for a pretty long period of time at a 53 to 60 degrees. And even if you're not wearing a wetsuit, you know, most open water athletes can operate for long periods of time at that temperature. And so that's a pretty good temp as well. And then once you get into like, you know, warmer water, like 17 to 20 degrees, which would be kind of in that like 63 to 68 degree range, that's a lot more comfortable for a lot of folks for longer periods of time. Some people still find that's cold because when you look at pools at like health clubs, those are kept at like 80 to 86 degrees.
Yeah, they're like bathtub warm.
Yeah, which is like, you know, 30 degrees Celsius. So These cooler temperatures are still cold for a lot of people who aren't used to cold temperatures, but ultimately you can, you know, once you get above about 12 degrees Celsius, you know, or around 53 degrees Fahrenheit, you really don't have to wear a wetsuit, and your body will acclimate to that pretty well, and a lot of that discomfort that you experience at those cold temperatures will go away. As far as a wetsuit and my recommendations for wetsuit, like what I use is the Blue 70 Helix.
Me too.
I love that wetsuit. It is like it's got varying levels of thickness at the panels, like in the shoulders and in the legs. You could almost freaking like run in it. I was actually thinking about doing the Tough Mudder and the world's toughest mudder last year. I didn't wind up doing it. It was this year, a couple months ago, because I ended up going to Israel. But I was going to bring my Blue 70 Helix, and I was very comfortable with that, just because you can like move in it so easily. So I like that wetsuit with the, you know, it's the Japanese Yamamoto style rubber, which is a really good kind of gold standard style of rubber. It's got good paneling. I'm a big fan of that as far as a wetsuit brand goes. As far as learning how to swim properly in open water, if you look at like the one of the more popular forms of swimming, you know, probably because guys like Tim Ferriss have talked a lot about this, the total immersion style swimming. I'm not as big of a fan of that for open water swimming. It teaches you how to swim really efficiently in a pool, but once you get into waves and wakes and stuff like that, there's a book called the Swim Smooth book and a website at swimsmooth.com. And these guys specialize. It's owned by open water swimmers. The book is written by open water swimmers. Then they basically coach triathletes and open water swimmers. And they just know how to tackle waves, how to tackle wakes, how to swim in a style that allows you to cut through open water a lot more efficiently, higher stroke rate, you know, less of a glide, that type of thing. So, check out the book is called the Swim Smooth book. And I recommend you at least grab that book, get yourself a Blue 70 Helix. And then as far as the hypothermia goes, unless you're swimming in really, really cold water, especially if you're wearing a wetsuit, you don't have to worry about that so much. I mean, your body will acclimate. And if you do start to notice some of the symptoms of hypothermia, like you start to get really tired, it gets very hard to move your muscles. A lot of times, like it feels like you have brain fog and you're having a hard time thinking. Then, you know, that's a signal to get out of the water. But I mean, just stay close to the shore when you're swimming. Swim with a buddy if you can, and you know you'll be able to get out. The trick is to put yourself in a situation where you can get out of the water quickly if you need to. And then, you know, when you first
swim
get in the water,
perpendicular to the shore, so you don't have, or parallel to the shore, so you're not going straight out into the lake or whatever you're at.
Yeah, and when you first get in the water, know that you know, once you wait like 90 seconds, 2 minutes, it gets a lot more comfortable when you're first starting open water swimming. But those first like 90 seconds or so can be really kind of uncomfortable. And I recommend that you, before you get in the water, you like pick like a rock or a tree that you're going to swim to and let that distract you from the fact that the water is really cold. And also when you get out of the water, strategically place a towel because there will be some significant shrinkage. So just beware of that, especially if there's anyone around for whom the size of the crotch whole regions is a concern. So
and make sure to watch some old Tarzan movies for inspiration as well.
That's right.
If you really want to learn how to swim, watch Tarzan.
And speaking of Tarzan, Let's read our review for this week, because if you're listening in and you leave us an iTunes review, and we got a 1-star last week, somebody hated on us. But we can reverse that damage if as many people as possible go over there. Leave us a 5-star review if you enjoyed this episode, if you learned something from it, because that's our goal, is to kind of teach you useful things that make your life better, make you a healthier
person. That's not my goal. My goal is to be a jackass.
But that's right. Brock's goal is to make me sound smart. So head over to iTunes, leave us a review. And if you go to iTunes and you leave a review and we read your review on the show, simply write to ben@bengreenfieldfitness.com. Let us know your t-shirt size, and we'll send you this sweet gear pack. That's a Ben Greenfield Fitness water bottle, BPA-free, of course, so you don't make your baby stupid. Tech t-shirt for working out and making your muscles look big, all of the muscles you're building by doing your Diamond Dallas Page yoga. And then a really, really cool beanie that you could use when you get out of the cold water. after open water swims, or play strategically in crossfit.
That's what I was going to say. Like, so, you don't mean on your head, do you?
So that being said, we have a review this week called "Taking Dumps Never Sounded So Professional Until You," and it's a 5-star review by Dr. Heffalophagus.
Dr. Heffalophagus, I love it. Good name. All right, this is how it goes. He says, or he or she says, "Your book, Beyond Training, changed my life. I am a recent graduate of chiropractic college, and I am continuing my master's in acupuncture right now. Mm. I trained hard throughout school, even though I was constantly burnt out. Mm. After I graduated the DC program, I knew I needed to change something. That was about the same time I got your book. I cannot even tell you how glad I am that it came into my life at such a perfect time. Because of your knowledge that you share through the book and your podcasts, I have completely changed my outlook on training and my life, as well as gaining insight to share with my patients." Nice.
Wow.
Damn, dude.
Amazing. It's kind of like a book review more than a podcast review, but we'll take it.
Kind of, yeah. Huh? "Thanks so much for all you do. P.S. I appreciate that in your professional biohack lecture, you repeatedly said the phrase, 'take a dump.' It was exciting."
Yeah.
Exciting, really?
I don't really know if it was a professional lecture, but I do like to use my dump phrase quite excessively. Yeah. So, speaking of taking a dump, I'm going to segue again. And this one does make sense.
This is how you're going to end the podcast, is it?
Well, no.
Heading off to the crapper.
Pop open a bottle of bubbly and bring in the new year. Happy New Year! Yeah, for all of you listening in, Happy New Year. And as we go into 2015 and surge past the 303rd episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, I can guarantee you that we have even more fireworks, happiness, and wonderful knowledge on all things health, fitness, nutrition, and dump related coming at you in 2015.
Should old acquaintance be forgot? I'm just background music.
Check out the show notes, bengreenfieldfitness.com/303. Thanks for listening in. Have a great week.
Visit bengreenfieldfitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.